Education Committee to order. We have two bills that have attracted a fair amount of interest today. Senate File 612, Senator Benson, welcome to the Education Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I have Senate File 612 relating to health and under the education statutes. First of all, I would like to request someone move the A2 amendment. It is a technical amendment.
So moved.
Do we have the A2 amendment? Is that a minority? Thank you.
And while you're getting the A2 amendment, let me just briefly review. The
Senator
goal
Benson.
Of this legislation is to provide education and a course of action in the event of a concussion to parents, coaches, and student athletes. As many of you are aware, concussions have been in the news. With examples of professional athletes learning the lifelong consequences of recurring concussions and how recurring concussions actually mimic a traumatic brain injury. This legislation outlines the current best practices in sports medicine and gives parents, coaches, and student athletes the tools to be well informed about some of the serious implications of concussions. If a parent is watching their child play or a coach is watching one of their athletes, they can readily discern if an injury warrants pulling them out of a game. A broken ankle or a sprained wrist would prevent play and give pain feedback to the athlete themselves, causing them to stop the activity. Concussions, however, are different. There isn't necessarily pain as part of the feedback, and so awareness takes the place of some of that pain feedback, allows parents, coaches, and athletes to make the decision to rest that physical injury, recover, and prevent further injury. And that is why I brought this legislation forward today. I do have some supporting testifiers that I'd like to introduce at this time.
Yep. Senator Benson, if you would wait. I think if we're ready to offer. Someone would like to move the A2 amendment.
So moved.
Senator Nelson?
So moved.
Okay. This is the author's amendment. It's a delete all that puts it in the shape that she wishes to. There's no discussion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to ask David King to join me here at the table.
So, Mr. King?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David King, and I'm the Executive Director of the Brain Injury Association of Minnesota. We're a statewide organization that provides advocacy, education, and support services for Minnesota families that are impacted by brain injury. And I'm here today to ask for your support on Senate File 612, which aims to improve the identification and the management of concussions, thereby making our sport safer for our young athletes. We know that we can prevent more potentially serious brain injuries if we can prevent our young athletes from returning to play or practice too soon after sustaining a concussion. And that's why I'm excited to introduce our next testifier, because she can describe much more effectively than I can just why this legislation is so important to our young athletes. Kayla Meyer sustained multiple concussions playing hockey, and those concussions have changed her adolescent life dramatically. But I think it's best if Kayla tells you in her own words. Thank you.
Thank you, and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Okay. My name is Kayla Meyer. Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Senator A.D. Kroof, who is my senator. My name is Kayla Meyer. I am 15 years old. I am a ninth grader and attend New Prague High School. And I have a mild traumatic brain injury after receiving two concussions 10 months apart while playing hockey. I have been playing hockey since I was 3 years old on my family pond. A year later, I added a stick, puck, and net. Another year later, I joined my first hockey team, Mini Mites. December 7th, 2009, a day that changed my life forever. December 8th, 2009, my 14th birthday. I left home early from school, to go home after having a terrible headache. Over the next 10 days, I suffered constant headaches that Advil and Tylenol could not get rid of. I remember 4 days after having these headaches, I remember telling my teammates, "Guys, I'm having these headaches. I don't know why they're there." And they all looked at me funny and said, "Kayla, don't you remember falling and hitting your head at practice on Monday?" As soon as they told me, I remembered what happened. We were doing a drill when two girls fell and slid into me. I fell backwards and hit the top back area of my head. I got back up. Coach asked if I was okay. I said I was fine, and I skated for the last 5 minutes of practice. As I said earlier, I played for the next 10 days, participating in about eight practices and two games, knowing something was wrong, and my coaches did not suggest that I see a doctor. After those 10 days, my mom and I finally decided to go see a doctor. He said I had a concussion and we need to stop for 2 weeks. After this, I cried because hockey was a huge part of my life. Into my third week of a constant headache, my mom and I decided to go ask the coaches for advice, saying that they'd probably dealt with this before. All the coaches could say was, "Kayla, let's put a helmet on you and have you skate you through it." This I could not do because it hurt too much to wear a helmet and still does to this day. But knowing if I would have been able to wear a helmet, I probably would have gotten right back on the ice. This did shock me, though, because in those first 2 months of the season, we had already had 3 team concussions. 2 were from the same girl. For the next couple of weeks, I went to the games, supporting my teammates and cheering them on. But I would end up in the locker room crying because the noise would be too loud from the crowd and from the game itself. For me, the biggest part of my injury is noise. Little things that I never used to notice now bug me. Things like blinkers in the car, timers for the microwave and oven, and even the vacuum cleaner. Because of this, school is obviously very loud. I only attend a 3-hour school day, going to classes I need required to graduate. And when I do attend class, sometimes I leave in the middle of class and go in the hall or go to the nurse's office to rest. Instead of going to the noisy lunchroom, I eat lunch in a conference room where friends join me. And if they forget or are sick, I eat lunch alone. Some of my classmates have been great, but some haven't been. Because of my injury, my head is also very sensitive. Every day I have people pulling on my hair, which hurts, people whistling, which hurts, slapping the desk, slamming books on the ground, even though they do know about my head. It's easy for people to forget and hard for them to understand because when you have a broken ankle or a broken arm, say, "Okay, I can see that. I know it hurts." When you have a brain injury or concussion, you can't see it, and sometimes people just don't understand. In my 8th grade year after my injury, I missed 38 days of school. In my 9th grade year so far, I have missed 30. My mom and dad own a dog kennel, and I used to love to work, but because of my head, I can no longer work with the dogs barking and my dad singing annoying 70s music. Because of my injury, I have decided to no longer play hockey. Hockey was a huge part of my life, and I'm still around it today. Our town is a very hockey-associated town. We have other sports, but hockey's a big part. On both sides of my family, I have cousins who play hockey. My brother plays an intramural team at Bemidji College, so I hear hockey on a day-to-day basis. Players today have their mindset that I'm tough and strong. I'm going to get back out on the ice. I'm going to play. Whether they're a boy or girl, it doesn't matter what sport they play, whether it's volleyball, hockey, football, or even soccer. Coaches, players, athletes, team trainers, and doctors need more information about concussions and brain injuries. My coaches, they're great coaches, but they did not know what to do, even though we'd had tons of concussions already throughout their hockey coaching careers. And they told me to keep playing, even though I knew something was wrong and they knew something was wrong. What if I had not played those 10 extra days? Chances are, I'm not positive, but my injury time could have been a lot shorter, and I could have gone through a lot less pain. On a day-to-day basis, I have a headache every second of every minute of every hour of every day. As of the 7th of this month, I have had a constant headache for 16 months. My first concussion, I was only out for 4 days. I haven't been on the ice for my second concussion since December 16th of 2009. That date is etched in my brain. It will never leave. I do not want what I am going through to happen to any other student athlete or family. I am committed to helping others by being a part of the Speakers Bureau for the Brain Injury Association of Minnesota. I'd like you to be committed to help others by voting yes on Senate File 612 to help keep the Minnesota youth sports safe. When in doubt, sit them out. Thank you.
Thank you, Kayla. I don't know if I missed it, but did anybody ever suggest that you get some medical attention? I don't think I heard you say that you did go to a doctor or find out anything there.
Thank you, Madam Chair, but nobody suggested that I go see a doctor. My mom and I finally decided to go see a doctor after those 10 days, and he told me to sit out for 2 weeks.
So, Kayla, that's the only direction that you got was to just sit out?
I have seen other doctors, but I was just told to sit out at the first time. They never said, you know, go see other doctors or maybe go see a neurologist or a chiropractor or anything. That's all I really said was sit out for 2 weeks. You'll be fine.
Thank you. Are there questions that you have of witnesses? Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, would this be a time to offer comments? Or do you want to, are there other testifiers?
There's some other testifiers, but if you have any questions of these witnesses?
Well, I just...
Or the author?
Madam Chair and Kayla, I have two sons, two student athletes, and they both, very unusual, suffered severe sports-related concussions, both life-changing. You know, it was very strange. I had a son who was a baseball player, a catcher. He suffered such a severe concussion that it was a year and a half before he was himself, and it changed his college career because he had planned to play college. And in fact, he's now 26 and thought he was completely fine. And 2 years ago was on a Ferris wheel just for fun and found that all those symptoms came back again. And so it never really does go away. And then my 23-year-old, his football career was cut short by a concussion, and in his case, he, after having a terrible, terrible blow to his head, they told me, you know, take him home, and he was throwing up outside the car door and crying and screaming, and I ended up calling 911, and they said he should have never been allowed to leave the field. He should have gone out on a stretcher. And again, it took, you know, quite some time. And so as we watch what happened with Justin Morneau and how long that took, I'm so pleased that Senator Benson is bringing this forward, and I don't have much tolerance for any resistance to doing what's best for you young people, because I have personally witnessed the life-changing impacts of sports-related concussions. So thank you.
Senator DeGrave.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question. How long after you were injured was your coach made aware? Did he know right away, he or she?
He did not know right away. He did see me hit my head, but I said I was okay. I didn't really, at the time there, I did not have a headache. The next day I had a headache. And probably 4 or 5 days, I did say, Coach, I'm having these headaches. And he kind of just said, okay, do you want to sit out? And I said, no, I don't, because, you know, I wanted to play. But he didn't never suggested to go see a doctor, but he did know about my symptoms.
Senator DeGrave.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to learn from you. What in your opinion is the best way, I mean, teammates maybe knew that you were injured where the coach might not have known. What would you suggest that we do in order to, you know, help the coach, you know, learn more quickly that there could be a potential injury that's dangerous?
Thank you. I think coaches need training on the symptoms of concussions, and they need to be more aware of their athletes on if they're saying they're having headaches or neck pains or anything like that, because that can lead to, oh, I got hit in the head, I have a concussion maybe. If they see the player hit the head, they should sit them down right away. They should know to do that right away. You know, check things. If the team trainer's around, get their attention, come have them check them. And if maybe have them sit out for 10 minutes or so, and if they're not feeling any better, maybe suggest they go home or go see a doctor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? If not, we have a number of other people who wish to testify. Cindy Schlafman from the American Physical Therapy Association.
Actually, Senator Wilson, I have a couple of others that
I'd like
to introduce.
Senator Benson?
I would like to introduce Michael Bergeron. He's going to join me here at the table.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much.
Could you say your name for the record?
I'm Dr. Michael Bergeron. I'm a professor of pediatrics at the Stanford School of Medicine. I also serve on the Sports Medicine Advisory Committee for the National Federation of State High School Associations. That's the committee that oversees all the health and safety issues for all 17 sports across the nation. I've circulated a letter, or there's a letter in your packet. I won't read that to you. You can take a look at that. But I want to highlight a few key points today. All of us that are here testifying for this bill, and perhaps even those that may be against it, I believe are truly big fans of youth sports. None of us here are trying to limit participation in youth sports or keep kids from playing. There's a host of benefits that we all appreciate from youth sport participation. But with participation in youth sports comes risks, and risk of injury is one of those risks. And concussion is included in that category. So this bill that is before you is not going to prevent concussions from occurring in youth sports, just like helmets don't prevent concussions from occurring. But just as it is our responsibility as any adult stakeholder overseeing the care of children, just as is our responsibility to have a first aid kit on the field in case somebody gets a cut, it's our responsibility to have the right process in place and to follow that process should a youth athlete have a concussion. When a concussion occurs, the brain is in an energy crisis, if you will. There's a tremendous struggle of the brain cells, the affected brain cells, to meet the energy demand. Now, if the brain is stimulated during that period of time of energy crisis, and stimulation could be being in school or playing a video game, and it certainly could be physical activity, then the risk for long-term or maybe even permanent damage to the brain is much, much higher. Now, if during that period of energy crisis, before the brain is healed, there is a second impact, either to the body or directly to the head, then the results can be catastrophic. Now, as the science and medicine emerges on this issue, at a very, very rapid pace, all of us in this field are beginning to much better appreciate, particularly the vulnerability of the young brain to concussion. It was in Washington State, which is really the first state to have considered and passed a bill such as before you, a young man by the name of Zachary Leistat in eighth grade, during the first half of a football game, sustained a concussion, came off, and then reported that he was just fine. He went back in and played the second half and collapsed at the very end of the game and was in a coma for 20 days, had two skull surgeries, half of his head removed, and is just beginning to learn to walk after almost 2 years of rehabilitation. And just less than 30 days ago, down in Florida, there was a young boy, eighth grade again, who went out back to the field in a soccer game and had a second impact when he should not have been out on the field, and he died 3 days later. This is very real, and it's particularly real to the younger brain. The younger brain is much more susceptible and requires a much longer period of time to recover. Now, I know there's been a lot of discussion about liability. This bill before you is in direct line with all of the emerging bills and the bills that have been passed across this country. This is indeed, make no mistake, this is indeed the emerging standard of clinical care for concussion. This is also directly in line with the most noted and recognized scientific and medical associations and organizations around the world. So in fact, this bill reduces liability because it is the best standard of care. And specific to a coach, whether that coach is a high school coach or whether that coach is a volunteer coach, this bill, should it be passed, reduces liability because it keeps kids off the field that shouldn't be there. Without a bill like this right now, coaches, high school coaches, middle school coaches, volunteer coaches in the community are making clinical decisions to put a child back in or not. With this bill being passed, this reduces that burden and reduces that liability and simply takes the pressure right off the shoulders of that coach and gets the kids off the field and into the hands of the medical professionals that need to be handling this. Anyone who's been involved in youth sports understands the pressures from parents, understands the pressures from the game itself and the score. And it's the end of the fourth quarter, and we better keep somebody in. This bill reduces that burden, takes away that choice, and just gets the kids off. So this bill reduces burden, reduces liability, is the right thing to do. This bill, should it be passed, allows the youth of Minnesota to thrive as student athletes, and I emphasize student, because first of all, they are students. A decision should never be made to put them back in and increase their health risk because of a game, because of a sport. So I ask you to please consider this bill very, very carefully. The health, the safety of the children and adolescents are in your hands, and they need your leadership. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bergeron.
And you have Madam Chair, I have two more people who would like to testify, Mr. Mark Carlson and Brent Milliken. Have you come up together, please?
If you will say your name for the record, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Mark Carlson. I'm a physician with Sanford Health in Bemidji, Minnesota, and a parent of four student athletes. A concussion is a traumatic brain injury. And as with all brain injuries, it's a serious brain injury. And concussions must be taken seriously. Concussions are unique in the world of injuries. They are not visible on x-rays or CTs or MRIs. They are an injury nonetheless, an injury at the cellular level of the brain. And therefore, they must be taken seriously. A concussion affects the brain's normal function, as Dr. Bergeron discussed. It causes symptoms, headaches, dizziness, nausea, but also trouble concentrating, trouble remembering, difficulty learning, calculating. Unfortunately, we don't have very good treatment for concussions. The main treatment we have is rest, complete rest. When I take care of patients who have had a concussion, I tell them you need to be sleeping or you need to be pretending you're sleeping. And that's about the best we can do for them. Because a student athlete with a concussion has to rest their brain, they cannot usually attend school. And this is often one of the hardest parts of recovering from a concussion, as Kayla pointed out. The length of recovery varies widely. It is not true that it takes 1 week or 2 weeks or a month. Every concussion is different. Every concussed youth is different, and their recovery is completely independent of everyone else's. We do know that children and youth take longer to recover than adults. We have learned a lot about concussions in the last few years. One of the most significant advances that we have found is that a concussed brain is more susceptible to further injury. Invariably, another injury, another concussion, another head impact or even body impact causes the concussion to worsen. The concussed youth feels worse. They think more poorly. The duration of their disability and recovery is lengthened. The amount of school that is lost is extended. I had the privilege of taking care of a 15-year-old football player last fall. He had a very simple fall. He bumped into another player. He got dizzy. He got lightheaded. He wasn't really sure about how to play his position, but he didn't know what that meant exactly. He didn't have any pain. He thought he was able to play. He continued to practice and play for 2 weeks with his symptoms coming and going, and worsening when he would fall or hit his head. Finally, this coach talked to him and said, "Are you sure you're okay?" And they agreed, fortunately, that he needed to stop and take a break. 3 days later, he went to a medical provider. He was evaluated. He was diagnosed with a concussion. I got to take care of him sometime after that. He missed the remainder of the football season. He was completely out of school for at least a week and a half, and then was only able to return part-time for another 2 or 3 months. No, I don't blame the coach or the parents or even this youth for struggling, because it is a complicated issue. But certainly, if he had understood more about concussions, if his parents had understood more about concussions, and if his coach had understood more about concussions, maybe it would have been recognized sooner, and he might have received at least some protection earlier. Concussions in sports may not be completely preventable, but we can and should make every effort to ensure that concussions are recognized promptly, treated appropriately, and the injured are protected from further injury. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brent Milliken, and I am the president of the Minnesota Athletic Trainers Association, which represents nearly 600 certified athletic trainers here in the state of Minnesota. I'm here today to speak to you about our support of Senate File 612. Athletic trainers are allied health care providers that specialize in the prevention, diagnosis, and intervention of emergency, acute, and chronic medical conditions involving the impairment, functional limitations, and disabilities. Athletic trainers work in a wide variety of clinical settings, and among the patients that we serve are athletes of all ages, including high school and youth sports teams. There is no issue more important to our profession than our patients' safety and prevention of injury. Many times in our profession, athletic trainers are the first point of access to medical care. Injuries are a part of the game, and in many instances, our kids are resilient and will recover quickly. However, if they injure their brain and do not receive timely and appropriate treatment, the adverse consequences could affect them for the rest of their lives. While most kids will not participate in organized sports beyond high school, they will be participating in something other than sports. A Friday night concussion can lead to various serious consequences when the student returns to academics the following Monday morning. Concussions are serious traumatic brain injuries, but the signs and symptoms are not always as obvious as a sprained ankle or knee. Unfortunately, youth sports teams and organizations do not always have access to an athletic trainer or other qualified professional who can immediately evaluate an athlete. In those cases, this bill will help inform coaches, officials, and parents of the signs and symptoms of a concussion. This information will help those involved in youth athletics make better decisions about whether or not to remove an athlete from participation. It also provides parameters on how concussed athletes can return to play. If an athlete continues to participate after sustaining a concussion, or if they return too soon, this can lead to adverse and sometimes irreversible damage to the brain. Finally, this bill would protect coaches and officials as it gives them the authority to remove an athlete who is demonstrating the signs and symptoms of a concussion. When we talk about protecting our kids, yours and mine, this bill simply makes everyone, parents, coaches, and athletes, simply pause and make sure athletes receive the proper care and assessment to stop any long-term repercussions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Milliken. Do you have any other testifiers? Senator Benson, are there any questions you have of the testifiers so far?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Rieger.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And for testifiers or Senator Benson, how many states have enacted legislation similar to what we have before us? And is there documentation showing the reduction in the injuries and the various other claims that are being made?
Madam Chair, I'd like to answer that.
Dr. Bergeron.
As of last week, 13 states have passed similar legislation, pretty much all modeled after the Washington state law. There's probably about 28 states with similar bills under consideration right now. The evidence is beginning to come in from Washington State, given that they were the first and there's been enough years to take a look at the data. And the feedback that we get from the Brain Association in Washington State is that the cost to the state, to the hospital care system, has been dramatically reduced because the number of catastrophic or near catastrophic injuries have been reduced.
Thank you.
Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On this information that was handed out, it says there's 3.8 million sports-related concussions each year. Are the concussions generally a blow to the head, or can they also be, I think someone testified that it could be a blow someplace else. What is the actual
mechanism?
Process, I guess, for
concussion? That's a great question. It's important to understand that a concussion can come from a direct blow to the head and the force transmitted directly to the brain. But it certainly can also come from a blow to the body or just falling to the ground, and your head may never even come close to hitting the ground. The point is that the brain inside of the skull is in a fluid, and so it moves around. So that sudden change of direction, particularly if it's a rotational change of direction, destroys brain cells. And so that force is not stopped by a helmet. The helmet would just protect the skull from actually breaking. But the force is transmitted to the head, and typically what happens is the head slams against one side of the skull and then back to the other side.
Better stop.
Madam Chair, and now this legislation really deals with the result of a concussion after a concussion has occurred. Has the organizations that are participating in this type of legislation thought any more down the road about how they could prevent some of those 3.8 million concussions?
Certainly that's been that's a great question, too, and certainly there's been a lot of discussion about that. The only sure way to prevent all concussions would be to not move, and you run the risk in any physical activity. But I think one of the side benefits of a bill like this and going into law is that annually the athletes, the coaches, the parents are all reading about the risks and such. And so the benefit is that they recognize that the head should not be used as a weapon. So if we're speaking about football, for example, recognizing that concussions are serious brain injury, recognizing that they can come from a variety of areas, but particularly a blow to the head, I think the side benefit is that people become much more aware and start teaching more appropriate methods of tackling, if you will, and playing the sport and not using the head as a weapon. So there's probably those side benefits, but there's certainly a lot of attempts to try to design that proper helmet. They've yet to come up with the foolproof one, but it's being looked at aggressively. As I said, I serve on the High School Federation. There's a tremendous amount of effort being put into trying to examine ways to minimize the risk.
Thank you.
Senator DeCrave.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question. You know, in the middle of a football game, somebody goes down, you're not sure if they're how bad they're injured. To me, it's the trainers that actually are the people that actually have the time to take the athlete back to the bench and actually study and take some time with them. Are you looking to make sure the trainers, or do the trainers already have this experience that we're just trying to give the coach more power? Or should the trainer be the one that makes that call because they are trained to a higher level maybe than the coach is?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Milliken?
Yes, the athletic trainer is an allied healthcare professional that can make that call in terms of assessment of a concussion, in terms of making decisions on their ability to go back into participation, whether it's that day or later. Obviously, what we've learned here over the last 10 years, though, is significant in how how people are responding to concussions and the long-term effects. And so there's an educational piece that we need to continue to do among our own profession, but all healthcare professionals. But in many instances, athletic trainers aren't on the sidelines. And whether it's at high school, you know, even a lot of high schools don't always have an athletic trainer on a daily basis, or maybe they're you have an athletic trainer covering a high school that has 700 kids, and they might be at another practice or something else, and something happens. This bill allows coaches and to educate them so they can be aware and make some appropriate decisions. And if nothing else, at least get them out until we have time to assess, have they had a concussion or they just needed a rest for a few minutes or what, but as opposed to just letting them continue to participate with after having sustained a concussion.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Benson, I want to thank you for bringing this bill. This is a great bill. I think it will save many concussions from changing students' lives in ways that they wish it didn't. Now, this may have been answered, but I didn't. I apologize. I had to step out. My question had to do with I was just wondering about the fact on line 222. I believe it's required that someone who is trained in managing pediatric concussions be the person to supply the letter that would allow a student with a concussion to go back into the activity. And I guess my concern is, if that's the case, are we in danger in some of the rural areas? Do we have adequate access? Do all of our school districts have adequate access to people who are trained in managing pediatric concussions?
Madam Chair.
Dr. Bergeron.
One of the beauties of the language of this bill is that there is some latitude in exactly who could qualify to serve that purpose of returning to play. The important criteria is that they have training and experiencing, as you said, in managing pediatric concussions. That can be a breadth of people, a wide scope of people. As this process unfolds, as the education becomes more well-known and utilized, you're going to see individuals, whether they be school nurses, athletic trainers, various physicians, and such, become more qualified. Every day, healthcare professionals make a decision whether something is within the scope of their practice. And I think our responsibility doesn't stop, our meaning all of the associations and organizations behind this bill, doesn't stop with passage. There's going to be a very deliberate and comprehensive effort to get the materials from the Centers for Disease Control and other organizations through a number of conduits to get that education, certification, free training, all of that involved, so that people understand how important it is to operate within the scope of their practice and to learn what they need to learn to manage this. So I think, again, as the process unfolds over the next couple of years, people are going to become more educated, become more aware, and who can do it across the rural areas will probably be dramatically increased.
Senator Nelson, and that we do have more testifiers, and we have another bill, and we've got a time limit at the room, so let's...
My comment was just that I hope we don't have students who have to travel across the state needlessly. But, again, it's a good bill. My second question just had to do briefly with the annual online training. And are you planning on any monitoring of that or any enforcement of that? Is it on the honor system? What do you foresee with that?
Madam Chair.
Dr. Bergeron.
Yes, I've been through a lot of these questions. It is free online training. It's on the honor system. People will recognize the importance of doing it simply because they'll recognize the importance of the bill.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Senator Benson.
I took the online training over lunch. It was not that difficult. Very common sense walked me through it. So
thank you.
I did a little due diligence on that.
Thank you. Now I think we got another list here of people that Cindy Schlafman.
Thank you.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. If you'll say your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Cindy Schlafman. I'm an athletic trainer, and I've been an athletic trainer for 22 years, 21 of those years at De La Salle High School. So I've seen 21 years worth of kids with concussions and having to work with their parents and the coaches to determine if they're safe to return to play. I'm also a physical therapist, and I am here today representing the Minnesota chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association in support of Senate File 612. So we've already heard how all this is going to help increase the awareness and the education to parents, to coaches, to officials, as well as to the athletes on the severity of concussions. So hopefully through this and through use of these guidelines, all parties that have an interest in the physical health of these athletes will be able to coordinate and communicate together for the best outcome. This bill provides that appropriately trained healthcare providers are involved in the critical decision making of the evaluation, the management, as well as the critical return to play and safety with that, or return to activity. We applaud the Minnesota Athletic Trainers Association in bringing this bill forward. We support their efforts in protecting the health of athletes in Minnesota. We support this bill, and thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Thank you very much. So we have Ross Pletzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ross Pletzer, P-L-A-E-T-Z-E-R.
Welcome,
I'm testifying for myself. I'm a parent of several athletes, including one son who played some D1 basketball at Drake, former high school basketball coach and former AAU coach, former school board member, 20-year former trial attorney, including personal injuries, including head injury cases. And I've also been on two youth athletic boards, volleyball and basketball. I think this is an excellent bill. It raises awareness and it puts some things in place. I have a handout in yellow here. Don't know if Senator Benson seen it. It went to her office. I don't know if she ever saw it. Okay. The problem with the bill is a couple-fold. It doesn't have any teeth in it. I would suggest that you respectfully that you consider, at least at the school level under Subdivision 2, that you make the activities or the athletic director somewhat in charge of what goes on in the school. The honor system does not work. I've been there. I've seen it doesn't work in other respects. We can have the athletic director tell the coaches, I want to see your login times. I want to see your, you sign a paper that you're swearing under oath that you have taken the training. Secondly, I think the athletic director, activities director, should be aware of anything that happens at the school. Every single head injury should be reported to that person. There's got to be a central clearinghouse. There's got to be an accountability. Someone's got to check on the coaches. The athletic trainer might not be in the loop on this. Someone's got to report every head injury so the athletic director can check into himself or herself what's going on. There's no penalties for not following this. At the school level, I think that you might want to consider the Commissioner of Education should do some rulemaking and make some penalties. Thirdly, I think from an immunity standpoint, we've got to reemphasize that following this protocol doesn't, or not following it, doesn't make you more liable to lawsuits. I've done this before. I've seen how it happens. You're possibly opening up schools or their individuals to liability. And fourth, I've been on athletic boards. It's hard to follow the rules. It's hard to follow the 501c3 filings. It's hard to find insurance. A lot of them are very lightly capitalized. They don't have insurance. I'd hate to see some moms and dads who didn't follow this be sued and have to bring their homeowner's insurance in and have personal liability here. I think we've got to make some waiver of liability for that. Secondly, this is a very discretionary system. The judgment, as we've heard from the medical experts, of concussions and the treatment of concussions and the recovery from concussions is very, very subjective and discretionary. I would respectfully suggest, and this was done in New Hampshire, that you authorize a committee to look into the objective measures that are out there to measure recovery from concussions. And I'm not associated with this in any way. One of the processes is a software program called Impact. There's some information in there. It's very reasonable. A user fee could be charged for every athlete of $2 or so, and you could pay for the whole program. What it does is measure each athlete before the season. It's a 20-minute test. And then if there's a head injury, you have a baseline of where the athlete is. You can measure them on a periodic basis on the computer program and find out how they're doing. At least it gives some objectivity. I know from my own experience, because I pressured coaches myself and I felt pressure to put kids back in the game. You want your kid to compete. You want your kid to succeed. We all think that just shake it off, you'll be fine. Only because my wife protested did we not take my son out of a game after he'd been knocked on the floor, unconscious. I pressured the coach to just let him sit on the bench and put him back in. We ended up going to Children's Hospital, and he was out for about 3 weeks. It's an easy thing to do. There has to be some objective measure. We can't just rely on subjective feelings. The one member brought up the ability of people to judge this. The training that's out there has to be a lot more intensive than just an online course. That creates awareness, but it does not create a diagnosis ability, an ability to judge when someone needs to go back in. That's why I really want to urge you to look at objective software programs. It doesn't cost that much, but I think it sure gives an indication of when someone can go back a lot better than some non-baseline training. So I think it's a good start, but I think it lacks a lot of objective criteria that can make the bill better. So I respectfully urge you to look into those things. I think this bill in Minnesota can build on and be better than any of the other 14 bills that are out there. I've looked at a couple of them. They're aspirational. There's no enforcement. If you don't have enforcement, it doesn't work. And I've seen that in sports and in my own business. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Plutzer. Is there any questions? If not, we have several other testifiers. Jennifer O'Rourke from the League of Minnesota Cities.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke, and I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and it's my first time testifying in front of an education committee, I believe. We simply wanted to be on record in terms of this bill, because as a lot of you know, cities and some of the nonprofits that are referred to in this bill are often providers of a lot of the athletic activities outside of the school. I'm talking a lot of the times about what's offered at the elementary age or in terms of some of the athletic associations a lot of our youth participate in. And, of course, a lot of those situations involve volunteer coaches or coaches that are offered a very small stipend. Maybe it's a break on the registration for their own kid or a free T-shirt, which was the case when I was a coach down in Eagan last year for first-grade boys soccer. Our concerns really rest in the area of liability as far as this bill, as it moves forward today, whether it goes to another committee or such. But we want to make sure that the organization, whether it be the city or possibly a nonprofit organization, those folks are covered under the liability issues that have been brought forward. I think there's a reference in the delete all that maybe covers, talking about lines 2.8 and 2.9, that reference 604. In the opinion of some of our research attorneys with the insurance trust at the League of Minnesota Cities, that provision really only covers the volunteer coach. So we just wanted to be on record, and it's something that we've been working with the advocates for this bill as this moves forward, that we could have some broader language in here dealing with liability.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Anybody Madam Chair?
Senator Wieger.
Just a quick question. And I noticed that in the delete all, the line 1.4 refers to any city. Senator, is it your intent that townships not be included, or would that include your intent for city? Do we need clarification on that?
I didn't specifically, Madam Chair and Senator Wieger, I did not specifically exclude townships. That was an oversight. And if necessary, Council, can you?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Nguyen.
Madam Chair and Senator Wieger asked me to check with Council in our office about this. And I think specifically if we want to hit townships, we would need to say so.
And Mr. Nauman, I know that there's at least one place in statute where the term municipality covers them all.
Madam Chair, I'm advised that that's a proper
another
way to handle
too,
it.
Yeah. That I think cover cities, counties, townships,
yeah,
and school districts.
It's a little bit out of the K-12 purview, so I spoke with I spoke with counsel about this.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, and with regard to Ms. O'Rourke's testimony, Ms. O'Rourke, I do understand the concern about liability, and so I'm sure that Senator Benson will work with you on that, and I support making sure that enacting this doesn't put a burden on cities in any way. But I will say that my now 23-year-old, his first concussion was when he was playing eighth-grade community football, and there wasn't, you know, anybody there. That one was so bad, everybody knew to get him to the hospital. But, you know, these are issues that we have to do something about.
Madam Chair.
Senator Benson.
If I may address Ms. O'Rourke, I had a question about how the city's liability is currently covered. If there's an injury, even if the coach doesn't have any implied responsibility, there's an implied responsibility for the athletes whether they have this training or not. And I'm just trying to figure out where city liability is right now.
Ms. O'Rourke?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I apologize for that. Should have had an attorney here today from the League of Cities, to be quite frank with you. And we've been sharing language back and forth on the liability issue, and I'll do my best to get you an answer on that.
Thank you. I do believe we will be laying this on the table, so there will be some time for some work to be done. I think we aren't going to be able to do that all at the table here, and so it would be better to work on that before we act on it further. So thank you. And I believe we have Kirk Schneiderman from the School Board Association.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Kirk Schneiderman and represent the Minnesota School Boards Association, which includes all public school districts. And we haven't had an opportunity to speak with Senator Benson on this issue, but we've talked with some other people who are supporting this bill. And I just want to raise some issues for the committee to consider. And I think it's important to note that health and safety are all public schools' paramount issue. I mean, that's an absolute must for school districts and their employees. I think one of the issues that may need to be clarified for us is under Section 2 that talks about the youth activity issue. And we understand that it talks about up to the age of 18, but many of our activities take place at the 7th through 12th grade area. And so while it talks about youth activity in that area, I think that we should focus on the 7th through 12th area where most of the And from the high school and school district perspective, that's where most of our activity is focused. And then also within that issue is the issue of whether this would include school districts' FIED programs. Because under the definition of youth activity, I believe it talks about means any athletic activity related to competition, practice, or training exercises. So would that necessarily mean that we would have school districts have to apply this issue to kindergarten through sixth grade physical education programs? And I understand that may not be the intent, but when all the lights are off and we get the calls in the summertime from the superintendents and school board members on these issues, those are the kind of questions that they're going to have for us, and we better have an answer for them. And so lastly is the issue of trainers. And I think that most of you, we've touched on that a little bit, is that issue of equity among school districts. And we know that some school districts have their own trainers, and we also know that many districts share trainers. And I think that that's an issue that we're putting a large responsibility in the hands of the coaches who may be in the middle of a heated fourth quarter battle in football and trying to figure out what the next play may be while they're also evaluating the health status of one of their players. So I think some of those issues need to be considered. I think also is the issue of liability. While we may protect the coach if he or she doesn't, if incorrectly enrolls a player into the game, back into the game. I think that issue needs to be clarified as well, and we will certainly help you in trying to find a solution for that and what terms of liability would be for the school district and the individual coach. So that's all I have, and I'll stand for questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Schmiderman? Are there any questions? Not Mary Gilbert?
Madam Chair.
Senator Weir.
Is that one question? I believe the earlier testimony was that 13 states have adopted similar legislation. I'm wondering if you'd had a chance to talk to your colleagues in those other states, the school board organizations, to see how it's worked.
Mr. Schrader.
Madam Chair and Senator Weger, I've talked with our cohorts in the state of Iowa on this issue, and that Governor Branstad recently signed that, I believe, earlier this week, and supporting it. And they have raised some of the similar issues that we're raising here today, as on the issue of who's responsible for the training. Would it be the school district? Would it be the State High School League Association? I think that's one of the other issues that perhaps needs to be sharpened within this bill is under Subdivision 2 on page 2. It talks about the appropriate sports governing body. And I'm not sure it says including the high school league, but doesn't necessarily mean the high school league. And so I think that perhaps that language should be sharpened in that respect as well. So, Senator Wigger, I don't have any hard data for you in terms of what the outcomes have been for this. So I would certainly love to share that with you if we get any, though.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Gilbert.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert. I'm the legislative liaison for the St. Paul Public Schools, and we did get a chance to talk to Senator Benson. We share the same concern that MSBA had related to the broad definition of what a youth athletic activity is. As part of what we're doing with our after-school initiative, both at the school and in collaboration with the city, we're trying to get all kids involved in some kind of club sports of some sort, which would include anything from touch football to archery, badminton, swimming, and other athletics. And the way the bill is currently drafted, it would apply to all of those. Of the most concern to us is the provision on page 3 that says before any youth athlete can participate, you have to have a signed consent form from the parent. The kids, Mike McCollar, who was here, the principal from Washington, who runs a comprehensive after-school program that's really, really successful, all those kids that participate in the club sport do not sign the consent. They just show up, they participate, they get moved into teams, they play more in a club fashion, and it's not under the high school league. Obviously, the kids that participate in high school league athletics go through, you know, the consent and the training and the requirements of the league. But there's many, many, many other kids that participate in sports where the consent would be very problematic for us on an ongoing basis. As these kids come to us on the bus and go home on the bus, on any given field trip, we have at the same school 15 or 20% of the kids don't get to go on the field trip because they don't come back with a consent form. We have to provide immunizations at our student placement center because kids can't enroll in school unless they have their immunization. And even in the case where we provide them, we still have to, on a pretty regular basis, inform families that they can't come to school because they don't meet the terms of the law. So the consent issue is a big, big issue for us. And I think that in light of what we're dealing with in trying to get kids active, trying to have them be in safe places after school, trying to deal with some of the obesity issues, we don't want to put any barriers in place for kids to participate in athletics. So I would, and the burden on coaches that would be doing badminton and swimming and cross country and the like, where, you know, you don't really see a lot of concussions. And so we would urge that the consent provision be struck from the bill, and a more narrow focus of what would be considered an athletic activity.
Thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Gilbert? Senator Benson, any questions for her?
Madam Chair, I'd ask that someone move this to be laid over so we can continue work for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Somebody could
Senator Bonhoff moves that Senate File 612 be laid over for possible inclusion if we have an omnibus
as
policy
amended,
bill.
Yes.
As amended. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Motion
Thank
is
you.
Adopted. Thank you very much, and thanks to all of you who have come. This was given us powerful testimony.
Wasn't there a fiscal note on this? I don't know if they have something. We didn't have this.
Thank you. The next bill is file 901. Senator Peterson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I have a couple testifiers that would like to present some information previous to presenting the bill to get some background information if we could entertain that that possibility. They're ready to go here.
Thank you, Senator Peterson. If you would identify them and invite them to the table, we will.
Yep. First, we'll have Dr. Karen Cadigan from the U of M Early Childhood Task Force with a presentation of a report they did with some recommendations. And then Mary Kozak as a program officer with the Blandin Foundation, secondly.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Dr. Cadigan, welcome.
Excuse me one moment while I get my PowerPoint set up here. I am not familiar with PCs. Okay, here we go. Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Karen Cadigan. I work at the university's Children, Youth, and Family Consortium. We are part of Minnesota's Extension Service, and we provide information about research that relates to children, youth, and families to the public and other public stakeholders in the way that some parts of Extension provide information about weeds and gardening. We provide information about kids and families. Last fall, we had the great pleasure to lead the effort around this conversation about whether and how Minnesota should have an Office of Early Learning Task Force. I understand, or Office of Early Learning, I understand there are a number of people that want to testify about the bill. I'm here to sort of give you a summary of what the task force recommendation was, and I will be brief but thorough. Hopefully, you have a single-page, two-sided handout of a couple of slides that you might refer to. So this task force was created through legislation last year. It had 8 legislators, 8 agency staff, and 8 community members, including some of the senators that are here in this room. I wanted to provide a little information about why this issue even comes up, just a quick summary of the sort of change in context and the change in the public conversation about early childhood, relating really to 5 big things. One is our changes in scientific understanding of that early learning is as important as other kinds of learning, changes in the family economy, so having more families where both parents are at work, changes in the global economy, competition for skilled labor, certainly relates to our education system, changes in demographic trends, U.S. population is getting older, more diverse, and changes in public revenue and spending. Globally, as you probably know, there's a trend towards less public revenue and smaller government, and some might suggest that requires more from the public investment we make. Those are some of the sort of big picture things that set the context for why not just Minnesota but many other states are having a conversation about early childhood governance. So this task force was led by myself and by one of the leadership folks at the National Conference on State Legislatures. We thought it was important to have a national perspective for a variety of reasons. And the most important thing for you to know about the Office of Early Learning is that it has nothing to do with 4 walls and a door, that it really is, at its best, I think, more of a the function is more important than the form, I guess. And so what the conversation really focused on as we studied the issue from other states, talked to the public, and had discussion with task force members was how to better manage and get results from the current programs and funding streams that Minnesota currently has. So that the functional priorities of a new governance structure should be able to do these things, should be able to deliver, have a seamless delivery system, should be able to creatively consolidate and coordinate resources among programs and agencies, should be able to have a framework for early care and education resulting in better efficiencies, and should be able to manage and develop a manage an effective data collection system. As you probably know, the way that Minnesota currently funds and provides services for a variety of birth to five-year-old programs and their families, it's housed in some say four, but really three main agencies, sort of health, human services, and education. And so the impetus for this idea was, would there be a better way with a single point of contact, a single administrative structure that could get more for that, for those resources? So the idea of this is not, in no way was this conversation related to adding more or subtracting from current existing early childhood funds and programs. It's really about, so if the state has early childhood services and funding, how best should it be managed? So we talked quite a bit about scope, what would be the things that this office, if you will, or this person would be in charge of. Some things were charged by legislation from last year, from the bill that Senator Michelle and Representative Peterson in the House put in. The decision of the task force was to include quite a lot of things, essentially everything in the Minnesota Department of Education that currently touches young children and their families. Nearly everything in human services, all the child care related grants and services. You'll note that licensing was not part of this discussion, and we could talk about that if you like, but right now licensing, child care licensing, is not part of this suggestion. In health, there are a few grants that relate to family home visiting and to other comprehensive early childhood services. So one of the great things about this project is working with Stephanie Clothier, with someone from the National Conference, and interviewing. We interviewed about 11 folks from other states, either commissioners, assistant commissioners, or directors of early learning. And what we learned about that is that if you've seen one Office of Early Learning, you've seen one Office of Early Learning. States do things very, very differently. Some of them, like Washington State, has a very, really does have a single point of contact for public and private services to young children and their families. Others, Virginia, for example, have more of a hybrid sort of model where there's a single person that helps the agencies coordinate a little bit better. So what the gist of what we learned from other states is that the making a change in a governance structure in and of itself doesn't magically improve outcomes for children or services for families, but that it allows things to happen. It sort of creates mechanisms that allows those changes to happen. So it reduces duplication, improves data systems. That's something we heard from a lot of people from every state that we talked to. And that it allows people to better coordinate funding, with sort of one person having a vision and keeping their eye on the ball of all the different funding streams and programs for early childhood. We also held quite a lot of public comment on this issue. We had an online survey that had nearly 600 responses. And we had public meetings in Virginia, Fergus Falls, Bloomington, and Windham. And the gist of that is that there is certainly interest in doing things better and having more communication. What we did not hear from anyone was that the current system, that the current support, that the current communication, the current system is working great. Please don't change anything. We didn't hear that from anyone. But there were concerns, of course, you know, if this office or this new government structure created more barriers, or if it just created another layer, if it is an additional, if it's just more government, that doesn't make sense. People wanted to know a little bit about what that meant for meeting programmatic mandates. For example, Head Start, early childhood special ed have different kinds of requirements. One of the interesting bits of feedback we got related to how people think, this is from the online survey, which was about a third parents of young children and about two-thirds people who were answering as providers or community members, that people feel that the current priority for young children is to get all children ready for kindergarten or that there's no clear priority. We asked the public what did they think the state's priority should be for young children. And what's interesting about this is it's divided somewhat evenly between among getting all children ready for kindergarten, supporting parents as children's first and most important teachers, and supporting children's healthy development. What's interesting about that is that those priorities align roughly with the three agencies that are involved currently, health, education, and human services. So the gist of the recommendation, we had about 3 months in which to conduct all of this work, including the public hearings. And the essence of the recommendation, there was a lot of conversation about what would be politically viable, what would make sense in this climate. But the essence of it really is to have someone in charge, to have there was a lot of conversation about what that would look like, what the best thing would be. But the consensus of the group certainly was that the closer we could get to that, the more confidence we could have in the way we spend our money and run our programs for young children, and the better we could remove barriers to helping get all kids ready for school. The specific recommendation from the task force was for sort of the highest level of someone in charge. That is a cabinet-level position and a separate office of early learning, and somewhat similar to the way that we have an office of higher education. So I'm happy to take questions. That's a quick summary of the task force report.
Thank you. And we have a second testifier before that you wanted to present the bill.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be with you today. My name is Mary Kozak, and I'm a program officer at the Blanton Foundation in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. And I was invited to share with you the work that our foundation has been doing with early childhood education in Itasca County. First, I'll give you an overview of our early childhood initiative, and then I'll share with you how I think our work relates to your legislative work. Our initiative in Itasca County is called Invest Early. It's currently in its 6th year of operation, having opened its doors in October of 2005. The groundwork started many years before that, when the Blanton Foundation decided to focus more of its resources on education. There are several partners that have been involved in the design and implementation of Invest Early. They include Kutaska Head Start, all 4 school districts in Itasca County, Itasca County Public Health and Human Services, and Itasca Community College. Other supporting partners include Adult Basic Education, Children's Mental Health, Special Education, and Bemidji State University. The core services that Invest Early provides include infant and toddler classrooms, preschool classrooms, parent education, and health services. Classes are available 5 days a week, 12 months a year. There's a menu of additional services that families choose depending on their need, like adult basic ed, transportation, extended day services, family development, and mental health support. When the Blanton Foundation first started the encouragement of developing an early childhood initiative, we explained the 4 components that must exist. They were quality, intensity, accountability, and systems change. And I believe that what you're most interested in is the systems change component. The Blanton Foundation was not interested in pouring more money into a system where all early childhood organizations continued to ask money for their individual plans, and then they continued their separate fragmented paths of offering services to children and families that didn't quite understand one from the other. We believed there was a way for all organizations to work together, thus maximizing their effectiveness and efficient use of resources. So how was this done? Well, I won't kid you. It did involve the Blanton Foundation offering to help fund what it would take to ensure there was a high-quality system in place. The partners that I mentioned earlier all had their mid-level managers at the table in what later became known as the Invest Early Leadership Team. They were the designers and implementers of the initiative. They excelled in collaboration and came to realize that the better they were in sharing and in working together, the stronger their program became and the more resources they were all able to leverage. The leadership team met every other week in its early stages, and they now meet monthly. Every year they sit down for a day and look over the evaluation report from Wilder Research, student assessment data, and the feedback from parent and staff evaluations. This doesn't include the constant assessment that takes place during the year. Assessments are done in the fall, winter, and spring, plus authentic assessments in between. I have yet to fully understand the language of IGDs and ECRs and ITRs and others, but I do know that all data is collected and sent to Wilder Research, and then they provide us with a yearly analysis. By the way, we have committed to a 30-year longitudinal study, and we'll be looking at the outcomes not only for our children, but for their parents and for our community. Some of the things that are unique to our initiative and that could be adopted by others in the state include a common application form. It didn't make sense for families to be filling out multiple forms with the same information at each place, especially when they weren't even sure which program they qualified for. Another unique feature is our blended classrooms. A Head Start teacher team teaches with a school district teacher in many of the classrooms. The classrooms have a mixture of kids, with some being funded with Head Start dollars, some being funded with school district dollars, and others being funded with Blandon dollars. Another unique aspect is that every kindergarten student in Itasca County is given the kindergarten readiness assessment, and this is versus the approximately 10% throughout the rest of the state. Data is collected quarterly from all sites by our special data tracker and is forwarded to Wilder Research. This data tracker is a unique position that was put in place from day one, knowing how valuable the data was going to be for future sustainability. Another thing that's unique is the countywide staff development and training plan. Other places, I think, would kill to have the coordinated and robust plan that is offered in Itasca County. And finally, they have individual learning plans for every student. All in all, our foundation has been pleased with the results of Invest Early. And just to give you a few comments from the Wilder Research, the highlights, they say that over the past 4 years, the percentage of children demonstrating overall proficiency or progress towards proficiency at the end of each program year is trending up. Home learning environments, which are associated with higher school readiness scores, improve significantly for the Invest Early families that are participating. And lastly, Invest Early narrows the proficiency gap for low-income students with other risk factors relative to their higher-income peers. Now, one thing I haven't even mentioned yet is the fact that Invest Early screens applications and takes in the neediest of all students. There's a risk factor ranking scale that is used, and these risk factors, in addition to low income, are all taken into consideration when filling the classroom slots. So when you see that the proficiency gap has been narrowed the way that it has been, you know that this project is on the right track. So what does our initiative have to do with the state? Well, right now, our leadership team has to fill out school readiness and Head Start plans, annual reports, and provide demographic information to one department, that is, the Minnesota Department of Education. Then, they also have to complete child care licensing applications, pay fees, and be monitored by another department, the Department of Human Services. Finally, they have to complete child and adult care food program paperwork and be monitored through the Minnesota Department of Health for the food they serve. All these mountains of busy work and paperwork do not even include the federal Head Start reporting requirements. The state is looking at ways to ensure that early childhood services and programs achieve desired outcomes in an efficient and effective manner that avoids duplication and maximizes uses of available funds in order to have all children ready for kindergarten by 2020. You heard from Karen Cadigan about how the task force has gathered research and traveled the state to gain input as to how to do this. They have put forth reasonable plans for carrying out suggested changes. The task force and the School Readiness Funders Coalition and Ready for K are all in agreement as to what is needed for the state of Minnesota. I am here to today to say that I believe we can have kids ready for kindergarten by the year 2020. When I saw the handwritten letter from an Invest Early father who was on MFIP and had no job, though he had 15 years of experience as an electrician, he ends up thanking Invest Early for the life-changing experience for him and his daughter. I know we're doing something right, and the state can as well. This father received a home visit from a family support specialist who helped steer him towards adult basic ed. He learned some computer skills, updated his resume, and ended up getting a job with a mining company in Keewatin. Now, everybody else around the state has these same agencies and organizations, so it's not like this can't be done elsewhere. I also wanted to just briefly mention the teen mom that was able to access our infant classroom and get health services through our program. She ended up being the valedictorian of her senior class and is now pursuing post-secondary education. Do you think that's going to save some dollars down the road for the state? So we are moving forward and bringing others with us, and I ask that you give serious consideration to the recommendations that you will be introduced to and realize that we all can work better and stronger together. And a packet was given to you, a folder, and inside it has some of the things that I mentioned, like the common application form that could, I think, be used throughout the state, a risk factor ranking form that I think one of the subcommittees of the Early Learning Council is already considering, as well as some of the other forms that have been designed. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Kosek.
Madam Chair and members, I need to offer the A3 amendment, and I'd be grateful for a motion from a member of the committee to move that forward.
So this is an author's amendment, Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the A3 amendment.
I don't think we have it yet, but we will have it soon.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
While we're getting that handed out, maybe I can just comment. Senator Peterson, this is a great piece of legislation, and I appreciate the fact that, yesterday, committee, we talked about the importance of having kids graduate who are ready to enter higher education. And in order to get there, they have to start here. And so this is a great piece of legislation that will help us make sure our kids are ready for kindergarten. And I particularly like the fact that you acknowledge parents as the first and most influential educators. I think that's key. And I also appreciate the fact of really deconstructing those silos that we've so often talked about in this committee. So kudos to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, the purpose of this A3 amendment really is to eliminate all costs. You've received a fiscal note in association with this bill that had a significant cost, and that's really what this amendment does, is eliminate all those costs for your consideration.
So this is an author's amendment. Senator Nelson has moved the A3 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Same sign. The motion is adopted. Vote prevails and the motion is adopted. Now, the fiscal note you said was fairly ample, and that is achieved by what means? Is that page 1, deleting lines 22 and 23?
Madam Chair, I can get those specific lines for you here. Just a moment. On the copy I have, it deletes line 2.11, 12, and 13.
That's not what our amendment says.
Okay, I have an earlier copy of the bill here, I guess. If I could ask for Mr. Nauman's help, I was very grateful for his attention, immediate attention to this issue this morning, and he drafted this A3 amendment, if he'd be willing to address that issue.
So, Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Nauman.
So, Madam Chair and members, the fiscal note carried a cost beginning in fiscal 12 of about $3 million, growing to 7.2, 8.7, and 10.9 through the projection period. The vast majority of that cost is on line 2.3 of the bill, the expansion of the quality rating and improvement system, and the amendment removes line 2.3 in the process. On line 1.10 of the amendment, it deletes lines 1 through 3. So that eliminates the quality rating and improvement system costs associated with that was in the fiscal note. In addition, the fiscal note also carried some substantial costs associated with the accountability framework and the report card as an accountability framework. And you'll notice on the amendment, line 1.9, we're deleting lines 22 and 23. And then that, as I mentioned earlier, we are also deleting lines 1 and 2 on page 2. So I think, although I'm not entirely certain, but I believe that we have reduce the vast majority of the costs associated with the fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Nauman. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill is really an effort to try and address two problems that currently exist around early childhood education programs here in Minnesota. The first one is the fragmentation of the efforts. We believe that the agencies and programs are not accountable to each other, providing overlapping services. And there's a little bit of a lack of communication and coordination between some of these programs. Really, the second issue is that there's no single person that you heard some folks previously address. There's no single person in the state who's taking full responsibility for ensuring that these programs are well integrated and are maximizing efficiency and staff funding. This bill addresses those two problems by asking the governor to issue a reorganization order based on recommendations from his commissioners to consolidate early childhood care education programs and some of their associated funding streams. The Department of Education will oversee them, and this person would report to the Commissioner of Education as well. You just heard that in the previous presentations that make a significant case for this idea. This issue has been studied compared to models used in other states who are faring much better in terms of achievement gaps and school readiness. This task force recommendations bill goes beyond what I'm suggesting. I'm not in favor of and not presenting in this bill any cabinet level position. Please understand that this bill is not creating a cabinet level position. It's simply just asking that we consolidate those resources from three different departments under one, the Department of Education. This has been done in the past. I have a document here. I just have one of them from Governor Pawlenty's administration that was done in 2003, where he did a very similar reorganization order, which consolidated programs from five different state agencies into just one office. You may remember that. It was the Office of Justice program within the Department of Public Safety, and that was done at that time with no cost and no fiscal note. This is not a complicated bill, but it is asking for real change, and it's going to ask you to vote for real change in how the state conducts business in regard to early childhood, and we'd be very, very grateful for your support to move this bill forward.
Senator Bono.
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, thank you for bringing it forward. I think you're in good company. If you look at the co-authors on this bill, Senator Michelle Bach, Stumpf, and Olson, I think that speaks to the importance of the bill in terms of the leadership in support of it. I served on that task force, and I thank and acknowledge, as did Senator Torres-Ray, I thank and acknowledge Ms. Cadigan and the University of Minnesota for her work, as well as who you'll be hearing from. Not only are they sitting at the table to give their support, they actually put their money in to pay for what it took to get the work done to this point. And so I think we are so lucky to have partners like the ones that you're going to be hearing from.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, thank you for pointing out the authors. I did have that on my list, and I'm embarrassed that I forgot to mention them. So thank you very much.
Are there any further questions, Senator Stumpf?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it is a very important area that we have tried in the past to bring some coordination and effort to this area. I think it was actually early on in session when we had that seminar over at the Humphrey Institute, and we talked about some of the silo systems of governance. And I believe it was Mr. Gopal from the Department of Administration talking about that. And this, I think, makes total sense. I wish we had the ability to do some additional funding. And I was just thinking that, and I'm taking kind of your side, Madam Chair, on this. There's going to be some savings as we move forward. And what we should do is plow back the savings into early childhood initiatives. Because I do think that streamlining it is going to do a couple things. One, it's going to create a better efficiency and more accountability in the whole early childhood area. The second one is the bigger benefit, and that's actually how we serve the users of this early childhood these early childhood programs, which are really the recipients of it. And I think that's going to mean a lot to them. When they, as some of the testimony, they don't have to go to several different places to receive the services, it's a much more streamlined approach. And that came out very loud and clear yesterday when I had a bill in local government to combine the county auditor and the recorder and make some of those changes. And Senator Roebling brought up the fact that in Scott County a number of years ago, she had a piece of legislation to do the same thing. Very apprehensive about it, hesitantly, you know, got it passed. And now today she was saying that the people that use that government center appreciate it so much, it's kind of like a one-stop shop for the services that they're looking for. And I think that's what we really need to look at in trying to help reform or streamline, whatever you want to call it. I think it's a good approach in an area that needs it. So appreciate your efforts.
Senator Stumpf, you're bringing up that agricultural term. Again, I was looking at this diagram. It looks like we were moving from silos to one big grain bin. Now, the question is whether they'll all be little compartments in there, which is what you have transferred, or whether there will be some other type of actual kind of change that you could end up with all the little populace still running little programs within one big place. Then, so there's more work than that to be done, I think.
Madam Chair, I'm sure that this committee will have to check up on them.
So, Senator Peterson, I think there's some other folks that would like to testify on this. Are you ready for that?
Yep, that's all, Madam Chair and members. That's all I was going to point out. We have several other people that want to testify in favor and some in opposition.
We do have just, excuse me, Senator Peterson, we do have this room until 5, so I would ask people to be as concise as you can in your comments. So which one did you want to come first?
We have Denise Mayonette. I'll let you introduce yourself.
Okay, thank you. So your name for the record, please, and your affiliation.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Denise Mayotte, and I'm the Executive Director of the Sheltering Arms Foundation. And thank you so much for hearing this bill and for all of your great comments in favor of it. Sheltering Arms is a small faith-based foundation that funds children's issues in Minnesota, including early childhood education. And we joined forces with other funders of early childhood program several years ago when we became a member of the School Readiness Funders Coalition, which you've heard referred to by a number of the people who've spoken. The School Readiness Funders joined with the Minnesota Legislature in the goal of seeing all Minnesota children ready to start school by 2020. We recognize and support the fact that parents are the first teachers and educators for their young children, as you mentioned before. And we believe those parents deserve the strongest and most coordinated network possible to support them in this vital role. We feel that the critical components to make this happen are leadership, accountability, and responsibility. And a key element of leadership is this position that we've been talking about within the state's government that brings together and coordinates the currently fragmented programs that serve young children. Our coalition is so committed to this role that we committed the funding to support the task force on an Office of Early Childhood that Karen Cadogan has told you about and as Senator Bonhoeff referred to previously. And I volunteered to represent the coalition last fall on the task force. It was a great experience hearing about how this role's made a difference for children and families in the various states where it's been established, as you've heard about in this conversation. And it was also really a revelation to me to see how the representatives from the three state agencies that contain most of the early childhood programs, how committed they were to trying to find a way to work more closely together to have this kind of leadership. We've seen the goodwill on behalf of early childhood, both in the public sector and also within private philanthropy and business. And we feel that bringing the early childhood programs in the state together with strong leadership that helps to reduce those silos and yet keeps programs intact will help move this goodwill towards results for children and provide the platform for a true public-private partnership. That's what it's all about, is a way for private and public to come together. We really feel that Minnesota's future depends on a great start for all of our children, and this is a great way to start. So thank you very much for hearing this.
Thank you. And Sheila Carrington?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sheila Carrington. I am a program officer for the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. The Women's Foundation is a member of the School Readiness Funders Coalition. The Women's Foundation is dedicated to growing equality for women and girls in the state of Minnesota. Over our 28-year history, the Women's Foundation has granted more than $12 million to fund and build the capacity of hundreds of innovative social change programs across the state. We also conduct valuable research on the status of women and girls in Minnesota to inform our grant making, educate opinion shapers and policymakers, and raise public awareness. Our goal is to build stronger communities and a stronger Minnesota. Economic justice is one of the five cornerstone areas funded by the Women's Foundation. The outcome for our economic justice cornerstone is creation of a future where women thrive economically and communities benefit when women, as a result of education, employment opportunities, and economic development, make poverty history. Our work in economic justice includes grant making and research. In partnership with the Institute for Women's Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and the University of Minnesota's Center on Women and Public Policy, we have conducted research on the status of women and girls across the state. On a statewide listening tour in support of this research in the summer of 2008, the Women's Foundation held presentations and focus groups in 18 diverse communities, including 12 in greater Minnesota. As cited in On the Road to Equality, our December 2008 report of focus group findings, in every group, whether urban or in greater Minnesota, access to quality child care was identified as the number one barrier to economic well-being for women. Overwhelmingly, focus group participants cited, and I quote, a broken child care system, end quote, as a deterrent for women securing and holding a job, continuing their education, and assuring their children's readiness for school. The recommendation of the study was to fix the broken child care system. Our latest research on the status of women and girls in the state, released in June 2010, revealed three important points. One, Minnesota has among the highest workforce participation rates for women in the country. Two, across all ethnic and racial categories, the majority of Minnesota women with at least one child in the home work full time. And three, Minnesota has the highest ratio of accredited child care costs to median income in the country, in some cases costing 50% of a household's income. As a result of these research findings, the Women's Foundation of Minnesota has chosen to invest our resources to help increase access to childcare for women statewide, which includes our participation in School Readiness Funders Coalition, as well as grant making to affect public policy changes that positively impact women's access to childcare. For the reasons I've stated, the Women's Foundation of Minnesota fully endorses Senator Peterson's proposal to consolidate funding oversight, rulemaking authority, and coordination responsibilities for all state early childhood programs. As a member of the School Readiness Funders Coalition, the Women's Foundation of Minnesota joins the call for increased responsibility, accountability, and coordination of early childhood education. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carrington. Frank Forsberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Frank Forsberg, Senior Vice President at Greater Twin Cities United Way. It's a pleasure to be with you. I also serve as the co-chair for the School Readiness Funders Coalition, a group of 12 philanthropic organizations that represent the entire state of Minnesota who are working collectively to address the issue of early childhood education. Very simply, we know that only half the children in our state are fully ready for kindergarten when they start. We embrace the goal that the legislature adopted not too long ago, that all children should be fully ready to start kindergarten by the year 2020. In these tough budget years, we think we can still make progress on closing this achievement gap with smart and simple solutions, such as in this case, integrating the 14 programs that are spread across three departments, all which focus on early learning. So the integration of those programs, or at least the alignment of them, I should say, under one leader in the Department of Education would be a smart and simple first step that we could take even during these tough economic and budget years. There's no question in our mind that the families and the children in our communities would benefit from this integration or from this increased coordination. And they would also, as a community, we would benefit from various types of cost savings in addition to those improved service delivery methods. So on behalf of the School Readiness Funders Coalition and United Way, I urge that you support this bill, and I think it's simply laid out in the grain bin diagram. I'll change the title as soon as I can. but it just is a simple way to show that I think we can, in fact, coordinate services across the Department of Health, Education, and Human Services to make a more efficient and effective use of the dollars and resources we currently have. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Ephraim? Senator Peterson?
Madam Chair and members, we did have two more testifiers in favor. One had to leave, Ms. Karen Kingsley, but we have Mary Nienel here that would like to testify in favor in Karen Kingsley's place.
Okay, we have about 6 minutes, and we need to be out of the room, and five of us need to be over in the other building for the start of the conference committee. So,
Madam Chair, did we take action on the amendment? I don't think we did.
Yes.
Yeah, yes, I believe. Yes,
it was
we
moved,
did.
But
I don't know if we voted on it.
We did.
Yep. We did. Okay.
Anybody verify? We did.
Thank you. Yes.
I've got a good memory, but it's short. Dr. Ephraim, why don't you go first?
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. My name is Karen Ephraim, and I'm here on behalf of Education Liberty Watch. And before I forget, Mr. Pritchard wasn't able to be here today, but he authorized me to say that he agrees with the concerns that we will raise. With all due respect to the author and to the motivations for streamlining government, we do want to raise some concerns about this bill. Even though it is attempting to streamline, the way it's written actually expands government control and over early childhood programs, and we are concerned about that. And despite the language about supporting parents in their role as the children's primary educator, the language about what the commissioner must work to do to develop a comprehensive framework for delivering early childhood care education premised on accountability for measurable and sustained progress, sustained and coordinated policy, funding leadership, and a strong and coordinated network of services and programs leads more to a government solution than private, and that is a concern to us. Also, the language in the bill about making sure that all children are ready for kindergarten by 2020 is, frankly, not the role of the state. It's the role of parents. And there isn't really clarifying language in here about government control on private versus public programs, and about 80% of preschool and child care in the state is private. And then there's the bigger issues of the effectiveness of early childhood programs, as well as the potential academic and emotional harm. And I've stated those kinds of things several times, so I won't take the time to do it now. But I just want to commend to your attention, and I'll leave copies if you want, of two articles in the Daily Beast and Slate, which are not exactly conservative icons of news reporting, talking about the newest studies that have come out within the last couple of weeks about the fact that early childhood directed learning, teacher-taught learning, is actually harmful to children's creativity and play and spontaneous exploration of the world around them. And that fits with the eight other large national studies that indicate problems with social-emotional development of children that are in preschool. And I have given you references to those before. There's also the issue of fade-out, and there's also the issue of the lack of improvement in long-term academic achievement, especially reading. And we truly feel that it would be much better to repurpose a lot of what we spend on early childhood, particularly Head Start, which is found to fade out by the end of first grade, to reading in K through 3, as you have magnificently done in your bill already, but to even do that more. And we do appreciate that the report card and the statewide quality rating system are out of the bill, because those would be major concerns as well. So I'll leave it there, and
thank you.
Happy to talk about that more.
Thank you. We've got a couple minutes.
Madam Chair, thank you. I have to be over in the SOB at 5 as well, so I'll make this very brief. My name is Mary Nino. I am the Executive Director of Child Care Works. We're a statewide child care advocacy organization. And really, I just want to express our support for Senate File 901. It was one of our top three policy priorities for this year. And it also was part of the Minnesota's Future Agenda, which is a coalition of early childhood organizations, and all 65 of those organizations statewide have endorsed this bill. So I want to share that with you, and we can certainly submit comments and answer any other questions you might have at a later time.
Okay, thank you. With that, I think we will lay this bill over for further consideration, and thank you very much for all of your presentation. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.
Okay.